Yeah, so I'm John Pearson. I'm from Durham. I'm a postdoc there, and this is work that I did in Manchester mainly, and going on in Durham with my old supervisor, Richard Batty. This talk is based on a chunk of papers, a couple of which are out. So this one's in JCAP. Second one's a conference proceeding, but contains more sort of descriptions, and a paper which I'm going to put out this week. So I'm going to be talking about parameterizing dark sector perturbations. This is roughly where I'm going to go with the talk. Quickly go over sort of cosmology and the dark side. What is it? How do people think about it? How do people model it? How are people going about parameterizing ignorance? How do people go about parameterizing modified gravity and what's going on? And then I'm going to go straight into sort of how we're tackling it, the formalism, and our approach and our philosophy. Then I'm going to talk about a neat thing which we noticed with our connecting our perturbations for the dark sector and how it connects to massive gravity and an interesting theory called elastic dark energy. And then basically the main thrust of the talk, the main thrust of the whole sort of program is constructing equations of state for dark sector perturbations, basically the equivalent of W. So W is the equation of state, the background. What are the versions of that for perturbations? That's effectively the whole point of the talk. And then some plots and the outlook for the program. Okay, so just by way of a very brief introduction, if you take Einstein's field equations with an FRW metric for a homogeneous isotropic background, you get a set of equations that, when solved for a given matter content, tells you about the evolution of the background geometry of the universe. And you can play the same game for fluctuations about that FRW background, and that tells you about structures in the universe. And this sort of whole picture basically yields a set of predictions for example, distances to things, what the cosmic microwave background fluctuation should look like, structure in the universe, basically how many galaxies should you see, or clusters of galaxies should you see of each size in the universe. It yields a set of predictions for this sort of thing. And these are things which we have observed. So in some sense, this is the standard picture. You take general relativity for the gravitational theory, an FRW metric for the geometry, and a standard matter content. At the moment, I'm just going to call that Barrington radiation, for example. And you combine that with data, so it gets a prediction, see how it is reflected by what we actually observe. And of course, we find a massive inconsistency. We find we have to invent about 94% of the content of the universe, 96% of the content of the universe, dark energy and dark matter. So what that points us towards is to re-examine the ingredients that went into the cosmological cookbook. What ingredients went into the model? So the gravity theory we used was general relativity. Perhaps the massive inconsistency is signaling something about general relativity not being the gravitational theory that we should be applying on large scales. Applying general relativity to cosmology is an extrapolation of the validity of GR as the gravitational theory. We haven't really tested it on those scales. In which case, we should talk about modified gravity. What about the geometry of the universe? We assume that it was on the background as homogeneous and isotropic. Maybe that isn't a good model for the geometry of the universe on large scales. Maybe there is some large-scale inhomogeneity, in which case you have to talk about inhomogeneous universes. What about the content of the universe? Maybe there's more to the content of the universe than we realize. This is where dark matter and dark energy come in. So roughly speaking, dark matter was invented for structure formation and galaxy rotations and stuff like that, whereas dark energy for cosmic acceleration. So these are just three ways to sort of try and reconcile the discrepancy between the theoretical prediction and the observation. So if one, for example, assumes that the universe is homogeneous isotropic and that general relativity is correct, we require the universe to be filled with about 24% of its dark matter and 73% or thereabouts is dark energy, which raises the question, what is the dark energy? Or maybe, as I said before, the observed acceleration is actually a manifestation of non-general relativity gravitational physics and large scales. I mean, this sort of thing, of course, has an approximate historical precedent. I mean, like 100 years ago, when we only had Newtonian gravity, and that was used to predict and was empirically derived from the orbits and planets the planets in the solar system. But when it got to Mercury, the orbit of Mercury was wrong, and in the 1860s, Urban Le Verrier invented planet Vulcan to sit next to the Sun, and the Newtonian calculation of the Vulcan Sun Mercury system was designed to work. But of course, Vulcan was looked for and it doesn't exist. And in some sense, the reason is because Newtonian gravity shouldn't hold so close to the Sun. So 100 years ago, 150 years ago, a planet was invented to reconcile Newtonian theory with observation. Today, 94% of the universe is being invented to reconcile theory with observation. So maybe that's pointing towards something wrong about the theory. Which, of course, raises the question, what is the gravitational theory? Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a strong field regime where it broke down. They also invented the other planet on the outside. Yeah.
So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. Of course. yeah. So we see an accelerating universe, which is caused by something which we now call the dark sector, I suppose, dark energy, causes apparent acceleration. It might be modified gravity, it might be dark energy, but call it the dark sector. And there's a lot of models which have been invented to try and describe what we see. Cosmological constant, the simplest quintessence, a homogeneous scalar field, a canonical homogeneous scalar field, k-essence, a scalar field of non-canonical kinetic term. Galilean is a scalar field theory with second order field equations, the most general version of that. F of R, adding a function of the Ritchie scalar into the action. Elastic dark energy, which is a not very well-known theory, but basically it parameterizes for the fluctuations of an elastic medium in the universe. Massive gravity, Einstein ether, where you stick in a time-like unit vector into the gravitating sector. Basically, what these sorts of models are what I've called sort of Lagrangian engineering, I suppose. You take the Einstein-Hilbert term and you engineer extra terms to put in the action. You keep modifying it, you keep putting in new functions. You engineer what you want to. You try and engineer gravitational theory. This paper here is a great review of modified gravity theories in cosmology. So here's a few of the popular actions, Lagrangian densities, I suppose. The point is here that there's a lot of theories which people have been looking at with a variety of field content. So just the metric, derivatives of the metric, curvature tensors, scalar fields, vector fields. There's a variety of different types of theories which people are looking at. So in some sense, we've come to the problem I want to try and tackle. What we have is a bunch of theories and for the gravitational physics in the universe. And what people tend to do is pick a theory and work out what its universe looks like. What does the CMB look like? What does the Lenz spectrum look like? What do distances look like? Structure in that universe. And so a theory will carry with it a set of free functions or parameters, and then you try and find out what values those free functions gives you something which you observe.
Wait, does Galilean provide any dark energy alternative?
Galilean?
Is there a solution to Galilean gravity that leads to acceleration? Or?
Yeah, I think, yes. I mean, there's problems with some of these theories anyway. So Galilean, some recent papers have sort of seemed to rule it out relatively concretely with a variety of different methods, so looking at the background and the perturbed solutions to it. Yeah, there's a cosmology of the Galilean, which gives accelerating universes.
So, but is the thing we say it's ruled out? How
does it rule out? So if you want the background evolution to work, it messes up the perturbed evolution. And if you want to make the perturbed evolution to work, it messes up the background evolution. So there are a few groups which have done, as in so compared with data. Yes, yeah, that's what I mean. So it doesn't give the universe that you actually see. Well, maybe you can at the background, but then it messes up the perturbations. It's all down to, yeah.
What is meant by Galilean?
The scalar field theory with the covariant Galilean terms. With second order field equations.
There's a lot of ambiguity in that.
Yeah, okay, let's call it Horn density. The whole the whole scale. The point is, it's a scalar field theory. Lots of free functions and lots of free parameters.
Yeah, there's so many free functions. How could that be
ruled? Well, okay. So the Galilean theory, which they're talking about, was one of the simplest flavors, where the coefficients are numbers, and then you can add in more complexity. Yeah. But in some sense, if you just keep adding in more complexity, you're going to find something which probably will sit with data, but it's whether you're okay with making something so hideous it's going to fit with data. But what people have also tended to do, going back to this picture, I suppose, is say, okay, here's some observations, here's some pictures of the universe. What does that tell us about theories? What sorts of theories from data could be realized by nature? And in some sense, that direction of the arrow is where I'm going with the talk. So here is a particular example of this. It came out, the data for the Canada-France Hawaii Lensing Telescope survey came out recently. And basically, the general idea is a modified gravity theory, whatever it is that's realized by the universe, will produce gravitational potentials which are different from what you get in general relativity. So if you take the conformal Newtonian gauge, is what they do, the two potentials, phi, and then there's some phi plus psi, are going to differ from their values in general relativity at order linearized perturbations by some amount, which they parameterize with two functions, mu and sigma. And for simplicity, because you can't parameterize for everything, so they pick these functions to be scale invariant, and they parameterize out the time dependence using two parameters, sigma naught and mu naught. So I'm not really going to go through the details of how they did this, but the point is, this is how people are sort of tending to use data to tell you about observation, to tell you about theories. So the whole game boils down to what's the values of mu naught and sigma naught that are allowed to be consistent with data. So they provide with a bunch of different types of data. So this is the archive number for the paper, which I'm on about. Combining different sets of data sets, they're able to put constraints on the two values of mu naught and sigma naught. So, but when both of those numbers are zero, you get general relativity. And adding in different types of data sets breaks some degeneracies, and basically it hones in on the lambda CDM picture. The point is that what they're doing here is they're parameterizing over two parameters, marginalizing over two parameters, and finding that only particular values in these parameters are consistent with data. But it raises the question, what sorts of models does this actually rule out, and what sorts of models does it say are allowed to be consistent with data? So for example, what I did here was I took a scalar field model, a k-essence model, which this particular plot is what is the value of mu as a function of scale and redshift. And so when it has the number 1, it's a general relativity value, and when it's not, it looks something different. So on very around this sort of region, you get a maximum of about 5% deviation, and everywhere else it looks approximately like general relativity. The point being, this sort of plot couldn't really tell you much about the sort of scalar field theories that this represents.
What's the green RSV constraint?
Yeah. All the details of this, I don't want to bang on about this too much, because it's the details in the paper, and I suppose this isn't the main point of my talk. It's trying to, So scalar field models will only produce roughly 5% deviations in these parameters, and which means that these sort of parameterizations couldn't really tell you anything about what's going on. This raises questions: what do the constraints actually tell us? So they have a bunch of numbers which they've marginalized over, but what does that actually tell us? Do theories actually produce large deviations of these parameters or not? Because if they don't, then these parameters are not very good at telling you much about modified gravity. So what people have started to think about is a good phenomenological link between theories and observation, getting input from theories, getting input from data, and trying to understand how this stuff is working. What's a good way to go about testing the nature of the dark energy? Of the dark sector, and what we're trying to do is basically construct a good, meaningful way to describe an observed phenomenon. So even though we're constructing actions, we're not going to be end up looking at fundamental field theory, trying to take an observed thing and understand a way to describe it. And in some sense, a word of warning to begin with, what we're trying to do here is caught between a tension of theoretical generality. So we could construct a parameterization which parameterizes over almost every theory you've ever thought of, but it will produce so many free functions you're never going to be able to observationally constrain them. So we are caught between a tension of theoretical generality and experimental feasibility. Okay. So I'll get going now on the formalism we've constructed for parameterizing the perturbations in the dark sector. So what we can do, basically the end goal is saying, okay, for a given field content, we have exactly all of the ways that the dark sector, that to parameterize dark sector perturbations. So we can say exactly how many equations of state there are for the perturbations for a particular field content. And those are the parameters which you end up marginalizing over. That's the end goal. So the way it works is basically what you do is you pick a field content for the dark sector. So you say, the dark sector contains just a metric, or it contains a metric and a scalar field. And then you write down the most general Lagrangian for perturbations for that field content, which just means writing down every quadratic combination of perturbations of those fields, which you can do. And once you have a Lagrangian, in some sense, you have everything. So you can derive field equations. We can impose a symmetry on the background. So we say, okay, you could do it in general, but again, it gives you too much freedom. So we say, okay, let the background be spatioisotropic and homogeneous, which is fine. So you're just saying it's consistent with a FRW background. And then we take the equations that we have and we work out how to close the equations of motion using what we call equations of state for dark sector perturbations. As I said, the end goal is to derive and obtain equations of state for dark sector perturbations which are motivated by generic classes of theories. That's the end goal.
So when you say derive things to close the equations, are they not automatically closed because you started from a Lagrangian?
We've started from a Lagrangian at the perturbed level, not at the background level.
What's the difference? It's still a Lagrangian, even though it's at the perturbed level.
Yes, I mean, yeah, it's... Hopefully you're yes, the equations of motion are closed, but it's basically to stop you having to evolve the field equations for a scalar field, for example. And it packages up how all of the stuff with scalar fields end up actually influencing observables, because some parts of the Lagrangian won't necessarily actually impact observables. And you want to obtain an understanding of how the observables are actually influenced. Hopefully that will become a bit more clear as we go on. So, again, I just want to hammer home the philosophy in some sense. There are loads of theories, which is rather bad. And what we want to do is identify the freedom within sets of theories which actually affects the observable quantities. How do the theories combine to produce the field equations? And you can study wide or general classes of theories and boil them down to regions of some parameter space. And it may well turn out that some theories in parameter space are degenerate, so lots of different theories may well produce the same values of these parameters. And in some sense, you can't do anything about that at level of linearized perturbations.
Isn't this exactly the philosophy of effective field theory?
Yes. So what this is not effective field theory in an energy scale sense, which is what we initially called our paper effective field theory for dark sector perturbations. But we got called up with calling it effective field theory because we're not doing an energy scale expansion.
So why the expansion
is it? We're taking a field content and understanding how all of that field content affects the observables. So we're not really doing an expansion in that sense. We're doing linearized perturbations. But we're not doing an expansion in scale or energy or anything like that.
You assume a particular field content.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'll show you some stuff in a minute. So the point is, for example, we might have found that the whole some class of theories boils down to two parameters, P1 and P2, and then you can go away and work out what values P1 and P2 are predicted to be for different sorts of theories. But you marginalize over P1 and P2 with data, not the actual theories. And then one can work out how the parameters trace back into the Lagrangian. They may well correspond to some symmetry in the Lagrangian. So if one had to be zero to be consistent with data, it may well tell you that some interaction gets turned off in the Lagrangian. This kind of thing happened in particle physics in the 60s and 70s in terms of how do observations actually change when you start all these different types of theories. And basically, we're just formulating cosmology in some sense. Okay, it's a bit of maths now, finally. This would be the background action the background action. So you have an Einstein-Hilbert term, a massive Lagrangian, and then a dark-sector Lagrangian LD. And that contains everything we don't know, or the dark energy modified gravity contribution. So LD could be that for an F of R theory, or whatever you want. And then the field equations look like this. So U is the dark energy momentum tensor. So all the dark sectors in there. And on an isotropic background, the dark energy momentum tensor only has two components, a pressure and a density. And when it satisfies the conservation equation, the density of the dark fluid is fixed. The evolution of it is completely fixed. And the only freedom left, so the pressure is not closed, it represents a piece which is not closed. And so you close the equations using an equation of state. So this is just at the background, nothing new here. So W, the equation of state parameter, is the only thing you can measure at the level of the background to tell you something about the dark sector. This is the equivalent expression, I suppose, for linearized perturbations. So the action which will describe the perturbations of this theory will look like this. So diamond is a measure-weighted variation. And this is the Lagrangian for perturbations in the dark sector. And again, you get a set of field equations. And the perturbed energy momentum tensor must satisfy the perturbed conservation equation. Yes, so we've assumed, so this thing here, this has a current on the other side. This is in some sense the simplest flavor.
And how ambitiously have you been here in defining dark sector? Are you thinking only dark energy, or you include dark matter?
Not dark matter. Dark energy, I suppose. Yeah.
Is there significance to the minus sign in front of the LD? Is it the energy going to be positive? Or?
Well, the energy will be positive, but this is just so that you can define everything in a sort of a sensible way. It's a convention. In some sense. Okay, so in the same way that you need the equation of state to close the background conservation equation, you're going to need something to close these equations. So how we actually do that will come to later. This is just sort of a trivial point in some sense. So how do you construct a Lagrangian for perturbations? So supposing we had field content x and y, the Lagrangian for perturbations is everything quadratic in those fields. And there's just three combinations for x and y. And that means there's three free functions only, A, B, and C, at the level of linearized perturbations. And A, B, and C can only be functions of background field quantities, which on a homogeneous space-time means they're only functions of time. All the freedom is now only in time-dependent functions, which is neat. Anyway, so that's sort of almost a trivial point, but it's just worth pointing out. So here's, in some sense, the simplest example. So let's say that the dark sector only contains the metric, so LD is a function of G only. So the Lagrangian for perturbations is that, it's just quadratic in the metric fluctuations, and so you had to put a tensor in W to make the thing a scalar, and W can only be functions of background field quantities, which are on a homogeneous space.
What is W?
That contains all information about the dark sector perturbations. So it's at this level, it's just a thing to make the Lagrangian a scalar. At this level, different theories, for example, give you an interpretation of what W is. So for Pauli-Fields massive gravity, W looks like this. It's some combination of the metric. And for elastic dark energy, which we can talk about a bit later on, it takes on a particular value where the components mean certain things. And then you derive from the Lagrangian, you can derive the perturbed energy momentum tensor.
So you're assuming there are no derivatives of the metric?
In this theory, no derivatives of the metric. That would require more terms in the Lagrangian perturbations. In some sense, I'm going to show you a couple of theories which are the simplest to get a flavor of what's going on, and then the paper which is about to come out will generalize things.
But in that sense, it is exactly an effective field theory expansion. There's a derivative expansion, you have your zero derivative terms.
Yes, in that sense, yeah. But in some sense, we have to sort of choose what the field content is going to be to get how many. So the question I'm going to pose is
the same effect of field theory.
Yes. Okay. Well, yeah, but they have a motivation for why they're truncating each term. Whereas here we're sort of saying, okay, supposing it's this, how many free parameters are there? And then what do they do to data? Okay.
The difference, one difference would be that the effect of field theory, you write down things to some ordered Dirichlet matrix, but you write everything down to that ordered Dirichlet matrix. Because I think you're saying you're making choices depending.
That's what he's doing too. That's right. The W here is general.
Is it? But it sounds like you're getting. So the question would be, given the symmetries of the problem, do you get all possible things in that tensor that you could have gotten? Or?
Yeah. So here, W is not a derivative operator.
No. But it's general at the zero.
As zeroth order, yes.
You haven't put any restrictions on them.
So there are restrictions which get put on it by construction in some sense, so in terms of symmetries and the indices.
Right, apart from symmetries.
There's no other restrictions placed on it, no. You can find out in an isotropic space-time, it only has five components, which is neat. So as soon as you impose a symmetry on the background, it imposes something. Okay, so. That's the simplest flavor. Here's the next one, I suppose. We've got a scalar field in its first derivative. The graph of perturbations looks like this. Perturbed dark energy momentum tensor looks like this. So there's three tensor objects which go into the dark energy momentum tensor. So which is five components, three and two on an isotropic spacetime. So imposing a symmetry of the background was quite helpful. So here there's only 10 in total. There's actually 74 free components before you can impose something on the symmetry of the background. So just by word of what this encompasses, this encompasses all of quintessence for arbitrary potentials, k-essence, shift symmetric or none otherwise, Lorentz violating theories, as well as, it automatically encompasses the theory I've already shown you. If you just set these two things to zero, then you get what I already showed you. Okay, so, in some sense, there's the two simplest flavors of our formalism. It already encompasses the first three things on this list. So Lorentz violating theories, that theory was able to parameterize for that. Massive gravity, linearized massive gravity, and multi-field dark energy, which is rather neat. And then formalism, which I haven't talked about here, but it will be in a few slides of time, I suppose. We're able to look at high derivative scalar field theories, vector field theories, theories of curvature tensors in them. I mean, this isn't an unambiguous list, of course, but biometric theories, and you're able to include couplings between the known and dark sectors. So you're able to do all these things using this formalism.
I suppose you're introducing 74 free functions.
So 74 before you impose a such from the background. So here there's five free functions on an isotropic background. This is the point. We want to do cosmology, which means the background has. We're going to say the background has a symmetry, and that makes it doable.
So I don't understand how it could have encompass multi-field dark energy, because let's say I have 100 fields in my dark energy sector. They could have chaotic behavior bounce around, go all sorts of crazy things. How could all of that be captured in this five parameters?
Basically, they combine to produce effective versions of these things. So whatever it does at the background, all it's going to do is influence the values of these.
But in that case, it's not going to be those five, right? Because you'll have to introduce 100 more fields with 100 more of these W's.
But in some sense, it works. You end up defining effective versions of these things, which are sum over 100 versions of them. But at the level of linearized perturbations, they just sum up. Produce it.
Is that assuming you're only looking at adiabatic perturbations? Is that the...
Something very different about single multiple model.
I think the point I'm trying to get across is the scalar field theories will manifest like this at the level of linearized perturbations.
It's also got to do with the number of free functions that you can constrain by observation.
Yes.
If you have 74 degrees of freedom, it's very nice, but you do need to make them condense them.
He's got only five, so that's not. You shouldn't put 74.
I do have a question, though. It's not Lorentz violating theories, are they always isotropic? is it necessary?
What do I mean by the retroviolating theories, I suppose?
Yeah.
So theories that don't satisfy reparameterization invariants.
Don't satisfy what?
Reparameterization invariants,
yeah.
For example.
Did you have, is this restricted just to adiabatic fluctuations? Because you can imagine that if you're looking at kind of fluctuations of the fields relative to one another, it's going to be hard to capture that with one field. But are you explicitly aiming only at adiabatic fluctuations?
I think so. I mean, so I'm going to say the main point of this is not about the multi-field dark energy. We're saying we can modify this stuff in some way to include that sort of thing. The point of my talk at the moment is trying to get across some sort of the simplest version and show how that can actually produce something which you can observe and do. I can talk about that later on, I suppose, but I want to get a bit further on first. So before I get something a bit more usable for an observer, I want to show briefly, in some sense, a trivial point that connects to a formula to massive gravity. So the action for fluctuations for a theory which only contains a metric look like this, where W looks manifested like a mass term for the graviton, it just parameterizes the quadratic parts. And in an isotropic space, W has a decomposition which looks like this. So U is the atomic univector, and gamma is a spatial metric. And the metric fluctuations have the Sugerberg fields in them. But then you can ask questions of it, such as what must the parameters A, B, C, D, and E satisfy to decouple various components of the Sugerberg field. So for example, if the naught component of the Sugerberg field was to decouple, then you'd be invariant under trion translation, or if the space parts, then you'd be invariant under spatial translations. So when you invariant under time translation, so design naught decouples, the only components of a tensor W that are left are those which exactly those which describe a relativistic elastic medium. So there's something called relativistic elasticity theory, which was developed in the 60s and 70s by Brendan Carter and collaborators, which basically lay out the formalism saying a relativistic elastic medium has an elasticity tensor, a W, that looks like this. And basically what it does is it describes the components of W as properties of an elastic medium, so a pressure, a density, a bulk modulus, and a shear modulus. And a bulk modulus is basically an evolution rule for the pressure. So these conditions here are what are satisfied when xi naught, the time translation invariant, is manifest. And then, okay, so supposing, what about keep xi naught in, but let xi I decouple, and the parameters have to take on particular values, so they become the for example, the pressure of the dark fluid or the density of the dark fluid. So in some sense, we're not doing anything new with massive gravity. What we're doing is saying, okay, when you have time translation invariants, the massive gravity which is left is exactly the same as a theory for elastic dark energy. So the massive gravity becomes, so the masses tell you about physical properties of an elastic medium. So the masses of the gravitons become determined by the bulk and shear moduli of an elastic medium. As this is just a neat thing, so we'll put out a paper about this by the end of the week. Okay, so let me get back in some sense to the main program. We want to take these dark sector theories and understand how many parameters you need to constrain with observation to tell you something useful about the dark sector. That's what you want to know. The whole thing boils down to a dark energy momentum tensor, the bit which goes on the end of the field equations. So for some general theory, which is more general than I've been talking about so far, is some derivative operator y and w, which expand in order of derivatives. So particular field contents will end up truncating these expansions to some order. So the theories that I've told you about so far, basically like f, g, and h were all zero, and then c, d were all zero, and b and a were non-zero in the scalar field case. So these are obviously suppressed indices, so G is some higher rank tensor, etc. But the components of A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, they're all of the three components. if you do a 3 plus 1 decomposition of it. I suppose in some sense, so what you can work out is exactly how from a Lagrangian perturbations you construct A, B, C, and D. So they can be all traced back to some coupling in the quadratic action. So you can work out exactly if some component of this had to be zero, it turns out that some interaction in the Lagrangian gets switched off, things like that. So I'm going to talk a little bit generally for now, and then I'll give you a specific example. So you went from a Lagrangian for perturbations into a perturbed energy momentum tensor. And what that prescribes is exactly how the field content, the scalar field and metric combine to produce the fluid variables. So the fluid variables are just the things which go on the naught-naughts, naught-I components of the equations of motion. So we have a perturbed density, a velocity field, a perturbed pressure, and an anisotropic stress. So the components of delta U just tell you how these things combine to produce whatever it is that's actually active, that's creating the field equations. So I call this, so you go from the fundamental field content of the dark sector, by fundamental I mean inverted commas, into the phenomenologically active variables. So it might all turn out that some of these things don't actually end up being in the fluid variables. You can work all that out unambiguously. And there's a direct correspondence, obviously. Now I'm going to prove this point in the next slide, but the evolution equation for these things are evolution equations for delta and theta for density contrast and velocity divergence, but not the perturbed pressure or anisotropic stress pi. So in some sense, they are the free variables, they're the bits which you end up being able to mess around with. So this is sort of what I mean. So again, we have our energy momentum tensor on the top, parameterize the metric fluctuations like that. All of the metric fluctuation variables, they have evolution equations, not all of them. They have evolution equations from the gravitational field equations. And then the perturbed conservation equation, if you just expand it out, just gives you the perturbed field equations. So just proving the point, I suppose. So you get an evolution from the density contrast and velocity fields, but not delta P or pi. So this is sort of standard stuff in some sense. So if you write down an explicit theory, that tells you explicitly what delta P and pi are. If, for example, you were to obtain expressions which told you that delta P was some function of the density contrast, its derivatives, and the metric variables which have evolution equations, and the same for pi, the anisotropic stress, then that would close the set of perturbation equations. They would represent equations of state. So all of the details of the dark sector would be sort of coarse-grained over it to tell you exactly what's actually happening to the field equations and exactly how the field equations ended up being closed. So here's a couple of questions which we pose. Are the generic forms, are these expressions, are these equations of state for wide classes of theories? Or moreover, are there specific types of equations of state for particular types of field content? The answer is yes. I'm going to show you what they are. So here's another rather generic example. So however the field content was constructed, if you end up with Y and W being these particular expansions, for example, so you've got up to three derivatives in D, in Y and first derivative in W, for example, this theory is rather wide. It contains quite a lot of things. And then you take this theory and you oppose it, so it only has second order field equations, and it has weird parameterization variance manifest. You work out the perturbed fluid variables in terms of delta phi and delta g and that sort of thing, and you find out that they all look like this. So the field content combines according to some matrix into the fluid variables. So it's the fluid variables which end up sourcing the field equations. So in some sense, this A thing is it tells you, so delta phi double dot doesn't go into delta and things like that. It just tells you which fields are combining to produce which fluid variables. The red ones are scale independent, they only depend on time. The black ones are maximum quadratic in K, so it's some time dependent plus time dependent times K squared. So we know exactly all the scale dependence of these fluid variables. But these have delta P and pi in them, and they represent things which are not closed from the equations of motion. But you can basically rearrange the whole thing. It's not the hardest thing in the world to do. And basically, so what we're going to do is write the perturbed pressure as an entropy perturbation. So we're taking W constant, but and basically the entropy perturbation These are the closure relations. These things close the equations of motion completely. And basically, so all of these theories only have delta, theta, h, and h double dots, and then the pi has delta, h dot, and theta in it. It doesn't have anything else in it. There are no other terms in the equations of state. And again, red is scale independent. Blue, it turns out, are scale dependent, and we have isolated precisely what the scale dependence is. It's not the most attractive thing in the world, in general. Here's a particular example which sits in that theories. So L of phi, kinetic term, and then box phi. If you write down a general version of that, it's Heibel field equations. You impose it, you say, okay, which series of those have second order field equations? The answer is just the kinetic gravity gradient set of theories. And then you say, okay, but this is now saying, okay, here's a theory. What does that look like in terms of that activation matrix? Which ones are zero? It turns out these components are zero. And the pi vanishes, the anisotropic stress vanishes, and the entropy ends up looking like this. And everything here is scale independent, including sigma. So there's a bunch of lambdas I've called there. And we've parameterized out all the scale dependence. And it turns out that sigma is proportional to how A depends on the kinetic term. So when A is invariant of the kinetic term, sigma is zero. So what we've done is worked out how a particular sort of theory produces a particular type of entropy perturbation. So all the freedom in that type of theories is parameterized by seven time-dependent functions. And it's those seven, for example, which you would marginalize over the data. So for example, if you found that sigma equals zero, it tells you something really important about the field content of the theory. So in some sense, this seven is rather endurable, especially as the time-dependent functions. You're not going to, in the near future, we're not going to be able to get anywhere near this. But this is proving a point, I suppose. So here's something which can actually do. The two simplest flavors. So all of the theories which have a metric only in them, no derivatives, just a metric, have equations of state which look like that. So there's a gamma and a pi. So there's one free parameter in gamma, and it only has the density contrast in it. It doesn't have theta, h, whatever, they just don't enter. And pi only has delta and eta, which is the off-diagonal metric perturbation. And so there's three free functions only in that particular dark sector, kappa, lambda, and epsilon. Functions of time only. In many cases, in some cases that we know of, they become constants. And in all theories of this kind, the entropy perturbation ends up looking like this. So it hasn't got a pi vanishes. There's only two free functions, alpha and beta. So there are a couple of particular cases in here which calculate values of alpha and beta for rather neatly. So when beta equals zero, it means you're in the sort of pure quiescence scenario. And alpha and beta, exactly the number one, you're in quintessence. So here what you do is you'd modulize over alpha and beta. You'd find out what values of alpha and beta are consistent with data, and that would tell you something about the nature of the dark sector. Or up here, you do the same with kappa, lambda, and epsilon.
Can I ask something before you? So you're saying which values of alpha and beta are consistent with data, you're still keeping, so there's five functions.
No, so all of those things, well, all that stuff has combined in some way to only end up being two things which end up actually being used to close the equations of motion.
And that's with background and with,
yeah.
Which sets of the data are you thinking of?
Well, also I'm going to come to that.
All right.
I'm going to come to that.
Yeah, it's just useful to have it in mind when you're saying they are.
Yeah, I'm going to show you what these do to data in a minute.
Okay.
Well, this is just a bunch of things. So, for example, what our parameters correspond to in terms of concrete theory. So, alpha and beta, if you take a scalar field theory, it turns out that it's this combination of derivatives and things like that of the actual theory. And in this metric only sector, this is how they correspond to graviton masses, for example, or the properties of an elastic medium. Anyway, so what do these things actually do to data? What have we actually got in some sense? If you vary these parameters, do they actually do something or not? So this is varying one of the parameters in the no extra fields case, so kappa. And this is the matter power spectrum. And so varying kappa doesn't really do a lot to the very large scales, but ends up changing the middling power, changes the scale of a lot of things. So this is things we have good data for. And so we can constrain these, what values of kappa are actually allowed.
So it's galaxies and CMB, basically.
So for this, for PFK, elastic dark energy. So this is also encompassed in one of the theories I was looking at, which was the Metrigoni case, and basically the whole thing becomes parameterized by the sound speed of an elastic medium. And again, dial the sound speed, we compute PFK, and you get a variety of spectra. So you can constrain what CS squared is allowed to be consistent with the data. And that's something we're working on.
Are you assuming some W?
Yeah, so here we've assumed W minus 0.9. So the effect gets suppressed as W gets closer to minus 1.
That's my point, is that, I mean, so you're not guaranteed that W is sufficiently away from minus 1.
That this much difference, yes. So as it gets closer, it's going to be harder. But that's going to be, frankly, true of a lot of things.
That's true. Really,
yes. But there's other spectra we can look at, which is just about starting getting data for. So this is the gravitational lensing of the CMB spectra and the lensing temperature correlation of spectrum of the CMB as well. And this is varying CS squared in the elastic energy case and alpha and beta. I'm going to show you in a minute fractional differences so you can actually see how big these things are. But if you go changing alpha and beta in some ways, then it changes the spectra again. So what this is now is changing alpha and beta and comparing it to a sort of a reference quintessence theory. So the difference in the spectrum that you get with a particular alpha and beta and what you get for a quintessence theory. So can you actually distinguish it? This thing here gives you maximum of the order 5% difference, which is very, very small. And over here as well, for the temperature lensing correlation spectrum, also gives you a very small effect. So the point being, these parameters are actually quite hard to observationally distinguish using, for example, lensing spectra. What about those metric-only theories? So so the top panel is dialing CS squared. It's not going well at all. And the bottom panel is dialing one of the parameters in the metric-only theory. I'll have to try and draw. So dialing the sound speed, you get up to about a 30% shift in the lensing spectrum, and you can get up to like almost 100% shift. So there is this line sort of goes up here and it oscillates around, so it has a very distinctive different signature to the quintessence scenario. This is one of the parameters again. This is very small, this is only 8% or so shift, whereas this is about 60% shift in the correlation spectrum. So these are quite large and rather distinct kind of signatures that different dark sector theories leave in observational spectra. Okay, so we did a very, very qualitative sort of survey. We said, okay, here's a bunch of parameters which we've got in our models. Let's vary them and then recompute the different spectra on large, medium, and small scales. Does a particular parameter end up affecting a spectrum a lot or not, basically? Really crudely put. So beta does not affect the CMB TT spectrum on large scales or small scales very much. This is just a bad probe of this parameter. Whereas some of the parameters end up actually affecting your spectrum quite a lot. Okay, this is very qualitative, but the point is it sort of gives you a handle on what sort of spectrum do you need to measure under what scale to tell you something about the dark sector. So here was a dark sector theory which only contained the metric, and here it contained a scalar field in a reparameterization variant combination. And all of these spectrum are going to get really well nailed down with the Planck data. Euclid, when it comes out, obviously, CFH, TLS, it came out. And we're basically working on using the data sets and forecasted data sets to constrain these parameters. So the idea is you can go from a field content of the dark sector to working out how many parameters ever will they end up combining into at the level of the nearest perturbations, and how do they end up affecting your observations?
Real quick, is there a physical reason to explain why things seem to mostly be affecting large scales? I just noticed a trend.
Yes, well, for the dark set, the dark energy is only just becoming apparent now, so it's only large scale stuff.
Okay. So it affects the CMB mainly through the ISW.
Yes. Yes. When so stuff affecting things on the large scales is a problem because your cosmic. That's kind of. Well, it's a good job that was almost the last slide. That's a new one. This is still fine. I think it's just done.
Oh, it's deploying. Ah, yeah.
There we go. yeah. So things affecting things on large scales are quite bad because cosmic variance limited. So there's a fundamental limit to which you can really ever constrain things. So in some sense, a summary of my talk, perturbations in the dark sector need parameterizing in some meaningful way. At the moment, my personal contention is that the parameterizations which exist are not particularly physical. You're parameterizing and marginalizing over parameters which is hard to get a handle on what they mean. What does it mean to have this particular region of parameter space preferred by data? But what we've done is basically construct a set of parameters which tell you about the field contents of the dark sector and can fundamentally be traced back to the values of some couplings or something in the Lagrangian. So this is approximately how we do it. So we work out a Lagrangian perturbation for a particular field content and then derive everything from that. And then the way that we package, in some sense, our parameterization, so that's effectively what we're doing, is we're packaging our parameterization using equations of state for dark sector perturbations. So it's how the field equations are getting closed. And we've done that, we've worked out what the equations of state are for different types of field content, and then we've computed signatures of some of these theories, and we're in the process of constraining parameters with data, and this is all stuff which is still in development. We've been doing it for a while, but it's still in development. Thank you very much. And yeah, thank you.
It's kind of something you and Ash mentioned earlier, the interplay between the background and the perturbations. You mentioned how most of these plots assume a particular value for W.
Yep.
For these theories, do you expect that the first deviations from cosmological constant are necessarily going to show up in W? Or do you think is there any regime where W can be within 1% of minus 1 and yet the perturbations be detectably different?
In some sense, to answer that question would require playing around with this. So in some sense, what you do is this is where data comes in, though, is the point, is that you'd marginalize what values of W and all these parameters are allowed. So I couldn't put my finger on a particular theory, which is, okay, if W is with an epsilon of minus 1, but the perturbations are massively different, I'm not sure to put my finger on that straight away.
Do you see any reason why it just can't happen? I mean, it makes sense that as you approach a cosmological constant,
yeah,
perturbations are going to become less and less important.
Yeah.
And does that seem to be that? I would expect that to be very generic, and you'd expect the same.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, I believe so. Someone gonna.
I was kind of correcting the image. Don't massive gravity theories have this property that they have solid, they have solutions that it hasn't got to basically consider solutions.
So my point here
is that massive gravity in general will have these self-accelerating solutions, but the perturbations might be completely different.
But then they don't have W plus 1.
They do
in the sense
that the background is asymptotic.
But W is this more specific statement. It's not W of minus 1 is not the infinite future, it's right now. Does it look like an MSGM is at the lambda background or not? And I don't know what the answer is. Does it look like? So when you go from matter dominated to asymptotic decision, how does the transition look like? Right, so that's like PGP is also like that, like the cell factor. PGP asymptotically you go to something that looks like the sitter, but the evolution doesn't look like the embassy and that's how it's with that.
So I suppose one of the things which we're trying to get away from with this approach to doing things is using data, using the data to tell you as much about theory as you can. So when you go dialing the value of W, dialing the other parameters, if it suddenly hits a regime which is not consistent with data, then that tells you something. And in some sense, all you can do is say everything that's consistent with these values are consistent with data. And sometimes that's all we're going to be able to do. Modulo getting really high precision data, and of course then type constraints. But fundamentally, that's what we're constrained by, is what we can actually point a telescope at.
You probably said that and I missed it, but I guess I'm wondering, by parameters you mean constants, whereas I'm expecting there to be lots of free functions, such as V of phi or f of x, whatever. What happens to it's much harder to constrain functions.
Yes, it is.
How do you get just parameters instead of functions?
Yeah. So, generically, these set of three, they're both functions of time. Generically. Now, when we derive what the values of alpha and beta are for particular sorts of theories, they end up being constant. So for all theories of this kind, alpha and beta are exactly the numbers one. Well, all the freedom in there is contained. What? Why? I mean, it is. I suppose it. Yeah.
I just expect to be functions of time.
Well, no. All the freedom is specified by.
Yeah, you expect them to depend on the background, for instance.
Yeah. No. These don't.
Are you putting in particular? Maybe that's it. Maybe you're putting in a particular background. That's what.
No. Well. So these things. So okay. So W is still a free.
You fix the background evolution, now you've got observations about that. You fix the background evolution, that's all.
Maybe I can re-articulate another way. Say I take, so there doesn't seem to be a continuous transition from V goes to zero from the second case to the first case. As I take V to zero, I must go to beta equal to zero, but there seems to be a discontinuous.
Well, so here, okay, so this is what they actually are. So alpha and beta for this Lagrangian look like that. And then if you calculate what the values of alpha and beta are, so here they are functions of time. I mean, there's nothing here, but when you take canonical case, alpha becomes the number one, you can see relatively easily, and the field equations end up coming into this.
For general L, alpha is a function.
For general L, alpha and beta are functions of time, yes. But in some sense, that's the same as W. So you have to take some approximation. You're never going to be able to fit for an arbitrary function of time using data. Almost ever, I mean. You're going to have a really hard time with that. So as a first approximation, you could take them to be constants, or you could look at some classes of theories and understand how the time dependence gets factored out. So some of these have sort of been arranged, so it's sort of almost a slow roll-esque type parameter. And see here, so alpha's here, but beta actually depends on the value of alpha. So you can start to link things and simplify things possibly.
So I mean, I'm happy with, for a particular model, there may be constants, but I mean, is there some general argument one which would be slowly varying functions? There's no general argument at all, is there?
I wouldn't give a general argument, no.
Yeah. So you wouldn't just constrain the case that these are constants, which is a specific class of things?
Yes.
Yes,
but in some sense, this is as best as we can do it. So these parameters in general, if you knew how to constrain arbitrary functions of time, that's it. But we don't know how to do that. And this is one of the things we can do. And so again, so in particular cases, kappa, lambda, and epsilon become constants, but in general, they don't have functions of time. In particular cases, they only depend on the value of the equation of state, the background. But again, there's only particular cases. But in some sense, once we have it tells you something still rather generic about theory space. And as far as we can tell, it's one of the more motivated parameterizations. So it tells you something about field content.
You put that in, otherwise you can measure this and introduce field content.
Yeah, so in some sense you could produce a hybrid equation of state, which, so when if beta was zero, it could put you over here.
So let me ask you a bad question. So just going back to how you marketed your talk about the turn of the last century, there was this anomaly with precession of Mercury is perhelion, and then of course we eventually found that modified gravity is the answer. So there, actually back then, there were efforts of similar sorts to parameterize gravity for the solar system. And like one idea was that instead of 1 over r squared, you have 1 over r some other power. And then if it's slightly different from a 2, this would explain the precession of the perihelion. And that didn't work. Eventually, the way that we solved that anomaly or solved the problem was by coming up with the more fundamental theory, and rather than trying to parameterize the deviations. And I wonder whether that might be also a lesson that can carry through, is that necessarily parameterization is actually, I'm a bit hard pressed to come up with examples in history of science where parameterization of ignorance have actually led to breakthroughs. Usually it's...
When you said 1 over r didn't work,
that would be, I guess, somehow historically that didn't happen. I don't know why.
But it could have worked that way.
It could have worked that way, but it didn't.
You could have predicted the precession of GR.
I mean, you could have predicted the first leading term of that GR would have given.
And then
yeah.
You
I mean, how? Mm-hmm. Sorry, can you?
Okay, well, I mean, if you said one of R somehow an alpha tune, how you get the agent of the precession, but basically the fundamental theory comes out.
No, but different. I think what Kurt is saying, instead of changing the power, you just added the 1 over r cubed term and fitted for the.
You would learn something by parameterizing.
Yeah.
That
you sort of found. So if you picked up parameterization carefully, you would have found that only particular values of the parameters give you something which looked like data. And in some sense, that. So, okay, there's an argument about, okay, why bother parameterizing? Why not go straight for your jugular and construct a fundamental field theory that holds on the whole universe? We don't. That's hard.
No,
so we're trying to learn something. So this may or may not, given various restrictions, this may or may not tell you something about what the field content of that could be. So, for example, if you said that
that actually points to the exactly the problem is that if you know what the right parameters are, then constraining them will tell us something about the fundamental theory. But historically, it has no as hard to just from blindness, deep knowledge, to know what the right parameters are. And yeah, so somehow people picked the right parameter to constrain back then, and it was only a fundamental theory that eventually set that situation.
Yep.
And it's the same problem kind of here, and the thing that there are different, if you believe in different theories, there are different good, quote-unquote, good parameterizations.
Yep.
And yeah, I mean, since we don't really know what the theory is, we don't really know what the right parameters.
Yep. Yes. I'm not saying we know. I'm not saying these are definitely always going to work, possibly. But the way that people are doing it, people are having these data sets, people don't know how to parameterize over them. This is one of the first sorts of ways of doing it in a meaningful way, full stop. Whether we learn something about the fundamental theory, I'm not Einstein, I have no idea, to be honest.